It's heterodox but respectable. That's a final line. But I had a choice. I prefer to be more heterodox and less respectable, but it's sort of, you know, goes back and forth. I want to put a point on the name before I get into the talk, and that is the name of Joan Robinson. Some of you know who she was, and a couple of you, Bill Jamie in particular, actually even knew her. I think that she's sort of a hovering spirit of this conference. One reason is that she spent a great deal of time near the end of her life here in Waterloo. She had a daughter who lived here, and after she retired from Cambridge University, apparently she spent a great deal of time here. I will not say very much about her because I need to get to my talk, but I will note that she should have gotten the Nobel Prize in Economics, did not. Still is not that woman getting the Nobel Prize in Economics one of these days. She's one of the three people mentioned in the preface to Keynes's General Theory, which of course Keynes is back, and Joan Robinson therefore is sort of back too. She probably, if she'd gotten the prize, they would have given it to her for her work in industrial organization, which was very important, but more conventional. The aspect of her work that really is more relevant to this group and sort of a deep structure issue that's popped up is she did work on what are known as the capital theory paradoxes. I'm not going to get into the details of the capital theory paradoxes if you don't know what they are, things like reswitching and so forth. But let's just say that I think I mentioned it, Seti shows up in accounting. Problems about how to value capital, it's sort of very deep levels of problems of finance, and the kinds of things that lead to paradoxes of capital theory also in a dynamic economy can lead to the economy behaving in a peculiar and complex way. So Joan Robinson's kind of a very deep level person in terms of her work relevant to this conference. So I kind of view her as kind of a patron saint looming. Actually, on Friday, John Burbidge, chairman of the economics department here at Waterloo, was at the conference. He's an old friend of mine. I hadn't seen him in ages. Last time I saw him was in Cambridge when we were punting on the cam and I fell in the water. So he laughed at me. You know, that's kind of a joke. But he knew Joan Robinson quite well, so it's kind of, you know. Okay, let's get into this. The other times I presented this paper, it's always been an hour or an hour and a half. So I'm going to skip a bunch of things. This is just a bunch of PowerPoints. If there is a paper, you can find it here along with a bunch of other junk. If you lose that, just Google my last name. My website's like usually the second or third hit that comes up for my last name. So I'm easy to find. So Alfred Marshall's problem. For those of you who do not know who Alfred Marshall is, actually the most conventional neoclassical economics. Okay. He wrote a book in 1890, Principles of Economics, went through 8 editions. And if you pick up Samuelson's Principles or pretty much almost any introductory textbook, especially the microeconomics part of it, and it's basically just straight Alfred Marshall, what you found in 1890 in his Principles of Economics. He basically codified the law of supply and demand as we teach it to principal students, neoclassical marginal economic analysis. Blah. He couldn't be more conventional, all right? Except that Alfred Marshall had a dark side. So here's a quote, which actually I have found is now on the cover of the Journal of the History of Economic Ideas, Journal of the History of Economic Thought, that got part of this quote. Actually, this is from the 8th edition because he kept adding to it. Okay, so what does he say? Since when demand and supply are in stable equilibrium, if any accident should move the scale of production from its equilibrium position, there will be instantly brought into play forces tending to push it back to that position, just as if a stone hanging by a string is displaced. Okay, standard proof. But in real life, such oscillations are seldom as rhythmical as those of a stone hanging freely from a string. The comparison would be more exact if the string were allowed to hang in the troubled waters of a mill race, whose stream was at one time allowed to flow freely. Hang in the troubled waters of a mill race, whose stream was at one time allowed to flow freely, and at another partially cut off. Okay? And then the rest of this is added in the later editions, in the 8th edition. Nor are these complexities sufficient to illustrate all the disturbances with which the economist and the merchant alike are forced to concern themselves. If the person holding the string swings hand with movements partly rhythmical and partly arbitrary, the illustration will not outrun the difficulties of some very real and practical problems of value. Okay. All right. So Marshall actually, and it wasn't just Marshall. You go back and Walras, the same thing. If you go and read Walras, who's even more orthodox, if anything, than Marshall, the godfather of Walras and general equilibrium theory,
you know, have this nice mathematical theory and so on, and it's all neat and it's all solvable, except it wasn't really quite correct. But you go dig in the back pages and you find all these strange things where, well, in the real world, there's all this really strange stuff going on and these storms and this, you know, chaos and bizarre things, but we don't really quite know what to say about that, but that's what's really going on, okay? Now, the Marshall's problem is this, and it's the problem of this conference, okay? Marshall was actually a mathematician, although if you read his book, he kept his equations all in the appendices and he wrote in text, okay? And he very much was aware of physics. I mean, people like Phil Murawski who critique Marshall or people who attack Samuelson, Samuelson's really just kind of updated, fancified Marshall, would say what Marshall did was sort of he translated a kind of a simple version of 19th century physics into economics. Okay? And he was very aware of that. On the other hand, there was a very famous quote from the preface about how he said biology is the mecca of economics, or should be the mecca of economics. All right. So there's a question about which is it? All right. This is Marshall's problem. What should economics draw on more, biology or physics? Okay. So this is the question. All right. Okay. Let me talk about this term transdisciplinary. I think this may be more important than the complexity stuff. Okay. Let me put three terms up here. Maybe they're all up here. They're all up here. So there's really three terms. You hear them around, but I think I want to push the idea that people here should think about things being done in a transdisciplinary way. And econophysics and econobiology, and I don't know if there's a synthesis of all of those, which is maybe one of the bigger issues of this conference. These are transdisciplinary disciplines, shall we say. So what is multidisciplinary? This is an older term. This was popular in the 50s and 60s. If you wanted to get grants in the 50s and 60s, and you went on about how multidisciplinary you were, okay? So what is multidisciplinary? Well, you have these people who are very much in their disciplines, and they kind of get together, and they, you know, lob little missiles at each other. Oh, and here I am, the economist. And this is probably like what happened at Santa Fe. Some of you were there in 1986 or 87 when they had that conference, and the physicists were sitting over here, and the economists were sitting over there, and they were, you know, throwing their, you know, the economists were throwing their theorems at the physicists, and the physicists were laughing and throwing their, you know, experimental data back at the economists, and it was all kind of, you know, this sort of what's going on here. But there wasn't really any meshing. The communication wasn't very good, okay? Then you kind of got something later that developed, this interdisciplinary, okay? Now, what's interdisciplinary? Interdisciplinary was kind of big in the 70s and 80s. You want to get a grant in the 70s and 80s, then you're interdisciplinary. And what's interdisciplinary? Interdisciplinary was kind of creating little niche disciplines, okay? By the way, I get this kind of discussion from an ecological economist at Berkeley named Dick Norgaard. So what's interdisciplinary? Interdisciplinary was creating a little niche like water economist. So what does a water economist do? How do you become a water economist? Okay. So you go and you study a little bit of economics. Okay. Nice Alfred Marshall law of supply and demand. Don't need to worry about macro. Keep it simple. Keep it short. And you go study a little bit of hydrology. Okay. Maybe a couple of other things. Maybe some geology or something. But you know some hydrology. And then you go to work for the Army Corps of Engineers and help them do benefit cost analyses on whether we should build that dam or not. Okay. All right. You're a water economist. Very nice. Okay. So, now, what's transdisciplinary? Transdisciplinary is, in some sense, maybe trying to combine both of these. So we're back to sort of, in some sense, taking the disciplines more seriously, a la multidisciplinary, but at the same time, in some sense, trying to create syntheses. Not funny little narrow oddball things like a water economist, but something like, well, econophysics or econobiology. Okay, I don't know yet whether there's going to be any. I will jump to the end, and I think the only place where I see econobiology physics going on, if there is such a thing, maybe in some Santa Fe models, I don't know, Stuart or Sear. But a big one would be the whole climate change question. That's one area where you see it all coming together, okay? Because climate change affects biology. Certainly, it's a physics process. Obviously, then all of that's affecting the economy, but then the economy is, of course, feeding back into the both directly into the climate and the physics, as well as also into the ecology and the biology. So there's a really big issue where you, in some sense, have maybe the need for a real totally combined economics, physics, biology, transdisciplinary discipline. But I'm not sure that we've succeeded on that. Okay. All right, complexity, I think I'm going to keep this real short. This is the kind of stuff that I've written lots of papers on this. And, well, everybody here, I think, knows what complexity is. Small tent complexity is a bad term. Last time I gave this paper, somebody said, you're insulting these people. No, actually, I'm not at all. This is sort of what most people think of when they think of complexity. And it's what a lot of the people here do. Agent-based modeling, okay? Small tent, heterogeneous agents complexities, a la Santa Fe Institute models, a la Lee Tesfatsian. This is agent-based modeling, and this is sort of what most of us think of sort of when we think of complexity. There is a larger tent dynamic complexity that includes things like catastrophe theory and chaos theory and cybernetics and so on. And metacomplexity, you might say, is the very broad form of complexity. Metacomplexity goes to the level of Seth Lloyd. Many of you know that Seth Lloyd at one point, I don't know if he's still doing it, was collecting definitions of complexity, and I think he got up to 45 definitions that he might have stopped counting. Funny thing is that what I call dynamic complexity isn't on his list, but I think it's what most economists think of when they think about complexity, which is defined by how the system behaves. So what's dynamic complexity? I like dynamic complexity. Dynamic complexity, a system is dynamically complex if it endogenously has an erratic dynamic pattern. Does not go to a fixed point, does not smoothly grow or smoothly decline, or just some simple cycle. It has some kind of irregular cycle or discontinuous jumps and moving around, okay? And it's doing it endogenously. It's not like a new classical DSG model where you've got these exogenous shocks coming in and the model just instantly jumps from one equilibrium to another. Everything's all adjusted perfectly. Here we are, general equilibrium. We just went from one general equilibrium to the next one, just, you know, like that, instantaneously, overnight, all the markets just whoosh, immediately, you know, get there, no problem, okay? No, that's not what it is. It's that the economy generates these instabilities on its own. And we've been hearing about how that, everybody here has already heard. We've had quite a few people talking about how, you know, periods of calm in the economy, and what does this do? People get relaxed. People start relaxing their standards. They start to see certain prices going up, and they start to say, oh, goody, we're making money, and, you know, we're going to borrow lots of money, and we can borrow more and more money to, you know, let the prices go up. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and the next thing you know, all hell's breaking loose, and crashes are going on, and the world economy is tanking. Okay, so that's dynamic complexity, all right? It's an endogenous crash. And this is the kind of thing, in fact, it's one of the reasons why Keynes is back, because Keynes talked about this sort of stuff exactly. He described it. He became unfashionable because models that say, no, that doesn't happen. Everything works fine, and the only reason you see business cycles is if something unpleasant happens. We have a bad technology shock. I'm still waiting to hear what the bad technology shock we've had. Why? Does somebody know what the bad technology shock we just had was? Yeah, where is that? What was the technology shock that caused the Great Depression? I don't know. I'm still waiting to hear what the bad technology shock was that caused it. And Lucas and these guys said, they could never say this. So, oh, it's a technology shock. Oh, whoa, what? You know. Anyway, now the higher levels of complexity get into all kinds of other things. If you go look at Seth Lloyd's definitions, a lot of them have to do with computational complexity. All right, and sort of very recently, there's been kind of a big new argument. Volupalai and Rob Axtell and some other folks have been sort of, Sherry Marcos and so on, have been pushing, saying, well, really, computational complexity. A whole bunch of the definitions that Seth Lloyd have are some variation on computational complexity. And there's a lot of sub-definitions, and some of you in this room, in fact, I think know some of these very well. Okay, so I don't want to get into the different ones, you know, the sort of the in general, you can think of the minimum length of a program to solve something, okay? But there are other, that's messy. So there's a lot of variations on this. A lot of this goes back to Shannon information theory and Kolmogorov brought in probability. I don't want to get into all of that. I've got the book that's just coming out, which wasn't mentioned, I think it's actually in the handout, Handbook of Complexity Research. I have a couple of papers in there. One of them is actually a big discussion about computational complexity versus dynamic complexity. And some of that I will mention, I think, as we go on. But I would just say that one of the virtues of the computational complexity is that it can be defined much more precisely. And you can get very precise measures of how complex something is. Of course, there's a bunch of different competing versions of this. But that's something that's very attractive. Okay, and I would say that those who argue that computational complexity is sort of what we should think of, that's one of the big arguments. All this dynamic complexity, it's very fuzzy. Yeah, maybe we can say something's complex, maybe it isn't, we're not sure. You can't really say how complex it is, but computational complexity is very rigorous, it's very scientific, you've got these nice, neat measures and so on. So I will grant that, but I'm not going to get into that here further than that. All right, okay, econophysics. Well, I'm not going to spend too much time on this because we've already had some pretty good discussions of this. I think everybody was here yesterday morning for Doyne Farmer's presentation, and I think he did a pretty good job of kind of discussing where things are at on that. You know, there's been lots of applications. Mostly we've heard about financial economics and income and wealth distributions, but size distribution of cities, size distribution of firms. Well, a lot of this, Doyne was talking about a lot of this. There's gobs and gobs of stuff. One thing that has been mentioned, okay, I'm talking about the fat tails and power law distributions, and everybody's seen this until we're about to, you know, wag our tails and fall out the window or something. One thing I will note, and Doyne was talking about this a little bit, but I'll just make a bit of a further comment on it. The going back and forth between physics and economics has been a very, very complicated business. I mean, Doyne in some sense brought it up, because, I mean, who invented the power laws? Well, it was a sociological economist, Pareto. You know, of course, got picked up by physicists. You know, so now we have the irony of here it's the physicists who are coming back to the economists and saying, hey, you guys, you know, let's hit you over the head with hockey sticks or something. You know, get it together. There are fat tails out there. I mean, it's, you know, all the practitioners know this, but it's pathetic. You pick up textbooks on financial economics, graduate level textbooks on financial economics, and I mean, I don't want to pick on Andrew Lowe, who's here on Friday, but he's got a big graduate-level textbook. And, you know, it's about two pages that talk about the fact, and it's sort of buried in there. Financial returns have fat tails, but, you know, there's almost no discussion of this in any detail. You've got several hundred pages of this book that go on and on and on with Black-Scholes models with Gaussian. I mean, it's, you know, this is still the standard stuff that's taught. Okay, so the lesson hasn't really been fully absorbed. You know, I think it's going to be. I mean, the recent crisis has really kicked a lot of tails, fat or otherwise, and you know, a lot of people are kind of, just as Keynes is back, suddenly people are worrying about fat tails, suddenly now goes, oh yeah, we knew that, but it's still not in the textbooks, I mean, even graduate level textbooks, okay? So very, very kind of weird kind of disjuncture. You know, I mean, the Brownian motion and random walk, you know, I mean, it was a mathematician studying financial markets who first cooked it up, although Einstein did it on his own independently, but you know, there's a great irony. We tend to think of the sort of the standard conventional view of financial markets as being the Gaussian version of the random walk. This is what underlies the efficient markets hypothesis of FAM on the whole thing. Where'd that come from? Well, it was pushed on economists starting in 1959, really in the 60s, by a physicist, M.F.M. Osborne. Okay, so you know, the going back and forth here is really, you know, kind of bizarre. You know, we have economists influencing physicists, and then turn around and influence the economists. And I mean, the thing has been going back and forth. And we have sort of different versions of physics that are coming in at different times, but sometimes things are going the other way. So it's really, really quite a complicated story. And maybe what's going on here is another round of these funny interactions and who's going where and who's influencing whom. Okay, there's a lot of controversy. I might mention this, and this is probably something to keep in mind. Well, I think we're really getting past this. But there was a paper that came out in 2006. I was talking about it with Doyne. I think he was ticked off about it. You're ticked off with this. You don't like this paper, right? He doesn't like this paper. He doesn't care. Anyway, it's getting to be out of date. It's getting to be out of date.
Well, I thought it was misplaced. I mean, that they were criticizing, you know, like, it's easy to look around the field and find some mediocre work, right, and criticize the mediocre work. You can do that in any field. Right. You can always find people that are doing crappy stuff. Okay. So you ought to criticize the best stuff, and you ought to make your criticisms, you know, very, you know, clear in exactly what you're criticizing and who you're criticizing, rather than just sort of generic criticizing some, you know, weird. I mean, this was after a conference in Australia where there were weird Japanese econophysicists getting up and claiming extremely flaky things.
Well, we'll stay away from ethnic characterization too. No, Doyne was never. I don't think any fingers were ever pointed at you, and I don't think Doyne's guilty of any of this stuff. Yeah, so these are four.
I will say something I've at times been guilty of, because I think just to comment for physicist number two is actually surprisingly hard to get right, and as physicists, we're very poorly trained on that. And so I found that's a place where I've really had to learn and be careful, and economists in general do that better than we do.
Yeah, well, that's kind of an ironic one because, yeah. I mean, you know, one of the rather important pieces of this discourse has been exactly that physicists have been sort of holding economists' feet to the fire. But okay, you guys, here you've got these graduate textbooks full of these models, but that's, you know, everybody knows that's not what the data is. You've got all this data out there, it's got all these fat tails, and then you've got all these models that don't have them, and so what's the matter with you guys? Can't you get it together? Look at the data, be scientists like us physicists, you know? You flaky economists with your theorems, you know, look at the data. And then we have the econo physicists coming in and not really always being quite up to snuff on how to analyze the data. So it's sort of a real irony on that one.
Let me put a little comment, because I'm, as a practitioner, I have the data. I use bloody black holes, and I know it's not correct. But the fact of the matter is, if I trade, the only thing I can trade are a bunch of instruments. It's a pretty thin market. So the problem is also that you might have a super duper model. Well, first of all, you have to calibrate it day to day. You don't have enough data on a daily basis to basically do that. If you do something fancy like a stock vol model, in general you can alter it very easily. So you have to be very careful. And in general, the way you have to look at these things, and that's something which is something that this conference also should be aware of. At the end of the day, you operate using tradable things. You trade in and out of positions. And in that respect, even if you have a very beautiful model, and I mean, I agree that there are big deficiencies, but practically, you cannot always use the model you would like. So it also goes very quick. So you have some constraints that basically force you to simplify a lot of things. And actually, delta hedging and kappa hedging works pretty well on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I don't think there is a big issue there. I mean, there are lots of smart people from physics in the finance industry who really well know what they're doing. And it's not actually the models that fucked up last year. It's the regulations and the whole the fact that you have a very small market of big operators that basically together were all in the same position. That you try to model that would be a very good thing. But I think it's a little bit too easy to say, yeah, look, these idiots, they don't know what they're doing. That is not, I think, correct.
Can I put some numbers on what you're saying? Which,
sure.
I think is very correct. If you did the exercise of calibration, Black Scholes, as he's saying, look at data today and do the idiotic thing of assuming the constant volatility, but then you calibrate the implied volatility and so on, and do your delta hedging. And now say you try to predict the prices of when the options are going to be traded tomorrow as trade starts again. And then you say, so how much of these prices are correctly predicted within a margin, say 2%, 3% or whatever? How many do you think are correct within that margin?
You're asking me.
Yeah. What do you think?
85.
It systematically goes between 95% to 98% of the prices. So whatever fancy model, stochastic ball, Levy processor, truncated Levy or whatever, it's dealing with the 5% to 2%.
There's this old tendency in economics. Actually, it's funny. My friend John Burbage was joking about this. There's a tendency when people do it. This is economists being bad, but there are econometrics. There's an old tendency to quote unquote throw out outliers, right? Oh, here's this weird point out here. Well, let's just throw that out because it sort of messes things up. But in fact, sometimes the outliers. I mean, Taleb was talking about this. You know, an awful lot of kurtosis was one day.
Yeah, I mean,
October 19th, 1987. You know, so you throw it. Yeah, it's crazy. Let's throw that out, and all sorts of things look very good. You know, so.
Again, I mean, there is. These tails, there has to be done something, but it's on the level that you basically have a market where everyone is trying to trade in the same direction because they all have the same position on and they basically want to get out. And so that's what you were saying yesterday, that you basically have this reinforcing effect. And so, yes, you want to basically get some models that deal with it.
Well, you can overtrade it. I mean, you know, he's not here, and he would get mad at me for talking about this, but, you know, the barbell strategy of Taleb lost money for years in a row. And part of it was, in a sense, too many people were betting on, you know, big crashes. And so people were paying too much money for those instruments that were covering you for a really big crash. Now, last year, those instruments, of course, made lots of money, but, you know, you have a bunch of years in a row when they lost money. People have commented on this. You know, this problem of, you know, why do you have to dance to the music? You know, you come in and tell the boss, if you're in some hedge fund, and say, oh, there's going to be this big problem, we're going to have these terrible things, and here we should hedge against this, and what's it going to do? It's going to lose money for a bunch of years. And you're going to be out, because the guys who are betting on the things are going up and everything's fine are making money until they're not. Yeah, so late.
And you can rule this direction of discussion out, but I have a question about it, because I mean, you seem to be making this point because you're responding to claims that there's an issue with theory. And, you know, Black-Scholes is wrong, et cetera. But it seems to me the issue is not whether Black-Scholes and other tools that you have work from day to day. The issue is, why was everybody in the same position? That is, and again, I'm way off my field, but the efficient market hypothesis is supposed to be that the market has all the information because all the possible positions are taken.
Yep.
So the market has rationalized by everybody taking all the positive positions.
Yeah,
and
well,
if the big players are all in the same position, then not only is that
might,
stability,
might
but
they might have the proper idea, but the problem is, how do you get out of the position? It's not so much, it's a liquidity issue, right? So I want to trade, I have a certain position, I have a view, and I think that's correct, but then I want to execute, I want to basically liquidate my position. And I have to start selling, and I basically...
But what you're really saying is that it doesn't matter whether the model is good or bad. If everybody has the same model, you're going to have a problem.
Yeah, that is where you have an issue.
And this is also goes to something that I think has been a theoretical problem, which is people assign liquidity to instruments. Big fucking mistake. Liquidities are attributes of markets, not of instruments. Even in the treasury market.
If you want to make a new model, I would use liquidity as one of the big parameters. I mean, that is really what is...
Yeah, and you know, there were those of us who've been saying this for years, but, you know, it simply was outside of the boundaries of how to think, because if the markets are efficient, liquidity is
constant. But you have to keep in mind that people that trade actually do think about it.
I know.
But you have a bit outspread.
Oh, I know. And I have stuff from your rivals going back to the early 2000s, where they were internally and at a very high level going through extremely stressful tests for liquidity, instrument by instrument, which is one reason why I think they came out of this mess better than anybody else, not because they had a guy in Washington. So there were people who were keenly aware, before any of this blew up, that they had to be thinking in terms of liquidity as a variable for every instrument that they own. And they did better because they thought that way.
But one of the things that I think that Don brought up that was really important, doesn't get touched on enough, is that the temptation to model oneself as a price taker when one may in fact be a large part of the market is overwhelming. And even in the case of AIG Financial Products, where we had some contacts, it was very clear that before matters came to light, that they were in part thinking about themselves as a relatively passive player in ways that my guess is that Don's fund never thought of itself. It was modeling its own, the ship that models its own wake and the reflection of that wake back on itself is a frighteningly complicated problem. The other aspect of about these crowded trades is not knowing, how does one know how crowded one's trade is? In some places you can make a good guess, but very often you have no idea whether you're the idiosyncratic genius or but one of many people. And you know, given your point about theories that, about things that make theories, the idea is you can't say that if a bunch of people have a good model, you still have a problem. If a bunch of people have a good model, it's a bad model.
Well, that's what I said. But then the other thing, and there's a great quote from Perrin in Risk last year, I guess it was during the winter, about implied correlation and how you could look at a CDO and you knew the correlation was wrong. But if you were going to hedge it, you'll have to take the markets. And I think this is what Jerry's point is. If you're hedging positions, you have to take what the market's consensus view of what the model is on the basis of which to price your hedge against the instrument, even when you absolutely know that it's wrong. So that's the only way you're going to have a counterparty.
For example, when you get a correlation of 1.8.
Yeah, right.
We go back and we'll come back next time.
All right, well, I'm not going to go through this list. As I say, I think that those guys are four economists who are very fairly heterodox economists. Virtually all of them have worked with physicists and so on, so they're friendly to econo physics, and they wrote this paper, and there were responses, so there's kind of a big debate. And I think that, as Doyne put it, there have been some, shall we say, not very good econo physics papers that have been guilty of this. But generally speaking, this is an improving problem. Now, my solution is, that the economists and the physicists should work together so that each can kind of, correct the other's problems. This is the way out. But here's a warning. By the way, this paper by Lux is in my handbook. It's a very good paper. Thomas Lux is a very sharp guy. A warning. The physicists need to work with the right economists. You don't want to be working with the people who are cooking up PSGE models. You're going to get in trouble. Let me tell you the story about DDA Sornet very quickly, because so many of you know DDA Sornet. DDA Sornet embarrassed himself. Why? He went around holding press conferences announcing that certain speculative bubbles were going to crash at certain particular points in time. Now, most economists know that this is not a wise thing to do, and some of these things, of course, did not crash when he said they would. Part of the reason he got in trouble was that he bought into a homogeneous agent model of rational speculative bubbles. I will not show you exactly how this works. I'll just say that model is a so-called stochastically crashing bubble. The guy who invented it is Olivier Blanchard, who's now chief economist of the IMF. How does it work? It works, I can tell you very quickly, how does it work? It works that everybody knows that the bubble's going to crash, and as the bubble keeps going further up, the probability that it's going to crash rises. So what does this mean? That means that rational investors have to be paid a risk premium for the probability of the crash. And as the probability of the crash rises, that risk premium has to get bigger. So what does that mean? That means that the bubble has to accelerate ever more rapidly. And in fact, what happens is that in finite time, the thing explodes to infinity. And so basically, that becomes the basis for the forecast of the crash. Unfortunately, of course, agents in markets are A, not homogeneous, and B, not fully rational. So, poor DDA. DDA has learned his lesson. I had a big confrontation with him. Well, we were friendly, more or less, at a conference in Zurich last August where it's another paper, but we had a very large discussion about this whole matter. He agreed that he didn't like some of my characterization, and I'm not sure he likes Thomas Lux's. He's actually written papers with Lux, so Lux was really upset when Sornet went off and did this. DDA agreed that he had been, I quote, naive. So physicists have to be very careful which economists they work with. Heterogeneous agent-based modeling avoids some of these kinds of silly things that can lead one to embarrass oneself. But Thomas lays all this out in this paper in my handbook in great detail. I'm going to come back to that. Okay, complicated history, I already talked about that. Okay, econobiology. Now, this is not a term that's being widely used, and I'm not sure maybe it should be. It's a term that was actually made up by somebody who doesn't like econobiology. Some of you know Joe McCauley.
Yes.
Okay, I'm not going to ask what people think. Joe McCauley is a super hardline econophysicist. Okay, he's someone who actually says that we should not even teach principles of economics. Okay, we should just teach people statistical mechanics and statistics and math and physics, and that's it. And then we can do real scientific econophysics, which should replace economics. Economics is totally bankrupt. Forget it. Go away. He also doesn't like econobiology. It's soft, fuzzy, it's not mathematical. Yeah, you have complex systems in biology. Evolution is a complex process, but we can't really mathematize it. It's just a bunch of verbal hooey nonsense. We need to have science and equations and invariance principles. He's big on invariance principles. So I'm a little cautious about using the term econobiology because it's not something that anybody's. So say the only usage so far has been the negative usage by McCauley to say it's a bad thing and we shouldn't do it. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's been around for a while. Now, it's, what's happened is there have been several branches of it, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this. One is what has been called bioeconomics. Okay, and the godfather of this is actually a Canadian mathematician, Colin Clark, who's at UBC, who no longer wants to talk to economists. The last time I saw him, he was crying, literally. Colin Clark is the godfather of mathematical modeling of fishery dynamics. I think because there's not time and I want to tell you about a finance model, I'm not going to go through this these fishery models. I'll just tell you that I've written a lot on this. Essentially what you do is you have an ecological model of the biology of the fishery, and you link it together with the economics of the fishery, and you put this into a combined model, okay? And this has been being done since at least, you know, for 30 years. Colin Clark's been doing it. Now, Colin Clark, as I say, is originally a mathematician, but he ended up becoming an advisor of the Canadian government on fisheries policy. Why did he end up crying? Because the Canadian government would not follow his advice about the Georges Bank fishery, and it was after the Georges Bank fishery collapsed Colin Clark basically got very, very unhappy. I've actually tried to have him, I know him, I tried to have him referee papers for my journal. He won't even respond to me. I'm one of the economists he likes better than most, and he won't talk to me. Won't talk to any of us. So he blames lots of people. He spends most of his time bird watching these days, I've been told. But he's totally disgusted by the failure of the policymakers and the failure of the economists to properly manage things. But in any case, this is clearly real econobiology. This is serious stuff. Okay, and there's a lot of people been doing this, and I'm not going to get off into a lecture of that. If I had an hour and a half, which I don't, I would do it. Every time I've presented this before, I've put up the figures and shown you, but I'm not going to drag you through that. Let's move on. There's also, of course, lots of modeling complex dynamics of predator-prey models and so on. So there's a great deal, in fact. Macaulay's argument is basically wrong. I mean, there's lots and lots of very sophisticated nonlinear complex dynamics of ecosystem dynamics, predator-prey models, and so on and so on and so on. I've been involved with this stuff for ages. Okay. Also, you get the integrated models of climatic change. Okay, there are, in fact, nonlinear dynamics models of climate, which, in fact, bring everything together. This is, as mentioned in the beginning, is where you actually get, you might say, econobiology physics. There's a lot of econobiology controversy. Actually, something I'm staying away from, which has been more of an issue here, is the whole issue of evolutionary economics. That's too long to get into. There are many branches of evolutionary economics. In the Homo Selectus group, some of this has been mentioned, but there's just lots and lots of stuff going on. I will make a claim, by the way, that the journal I edit is the leading journal in the world for evolutionary economics. But I'm not going to go on about that too much. The most cited paper in the journal last 3 years is a paper about generalized Darwinism by Jeff Hodgson, actually. Eric. Yeah.
And if you go backwards rather than forward, if you follow the Bob Sherman, who's the start to you, or if you want to know, I don't think it starts off with the really great part of the conversation. Why is it we're not finding the top people in the reverse direction? And it's very easy to do soft.
There's a real unfortunate history there. There has not been the kind of collaboration that you've had that's been going on, I would say, between economics and physics. Econobiology, I mean, Colin Clark is neither he's a mathematician. He's neither a biologist nor an economist. Now, he's the father of bioeconomics. Trivers talks to some game theorists. So evolutionary game theory is one area where this comes in. But you talk to people like Soleil or Bosconte or some of these guys who are do very sophisticated models, or Kaneko or some of these people, and there isn't a lot of interaction with economists, and I'm not entirely sure what's going on there. Oh well, he's a complex evolutionary. He's got a chapter in the handbook that's coming out actually, which is actually an evolutionary game theory model. Oh, Herb and I are good friends, and I like his work. He's doing a lot of things, and he's got several irons and several fires going along. But he's kind of he's kind of in this econobiology to some extent. Now, there's all sorts of issues. I mean, there's a lot of the kind of thing that gets people like Macaulay upset are all these discussions about emergence and questions of organicism and holism. And there's a long tradition of that. And of course, there's a lot of, you know, I mean, this has been one of the big themes. A lot of Santa Fe people have talked about this sort of thing, you know, order emerging out of disorder and the edge of chaos and so on and so on. And some of this has come from the biological side. It's too bad Stuart Kaufman isn't here or some other people. But anyway, I'm not gonna go on about those issues right now. I actually want to. I want to talk about a model that Mauro Galligotti and Antonio Palestrini and I have done, which is about to be finally, after many years, accepted in a journal. The funny thing is, this paper is now being used in a bunch of grad reading courses. Still hasn't quite been accepted, This is now, actually, I'm going to do, yes, 5 minutes? Okay, I can do it in 5 minutes. None of you really need this, but I'm going to give it to you because I don't think you've seen it. But this is in the paper to say, aha, what's an example of something that an heterogeneous agent or agent-based model can tell you that standard models don't? Okay, so this is one example. It's not the only one, but it's a nice one. Okay, so let me show you something. I'll do it over here. Go see your daughter. There's a very excellent book many of you know about Hyman Minsky. Minsky's back like Keynes. Minsky also is a big influence on Charles Kindleberger, my old friend Kindleberger. I knew both Minsky and Kindleberger. Kindleberger wrote an excellent book. There's no math in it at all. Manias, Panics, and Crashes. Many of you have probably seen this book. It's been through a bunch of editions. It was originally in 1978. The last edition that was... fourth edition, the last one he did before he died, is I think, or 2001. Somebody else has done an edition since. A very interesting thing in this book is Appendix B. And I would say go look at the fourth edition, because he keeps expanding Appendix D. Now, what Appendix B is he basically goes through, and the list got longer and longer, he goes and looks at pretty much all of the famous historical speculative bubbles. And in the fourth edition, he's got it all the way up to 47. Starting with the crash of the Holy Roman Empire currency at the beginning of the 30 Years' War in 1618, all right, and going up to the crash of the NASDAQ. We don't know. You don't know anything about that, right? So, the crash of the NASDAQ. Lots and lots and lots of bubbles. And he also lays out three different models of bubbles. One of the things about this Appendix B is it gives dates. So he has the beginning. Peak, crash. And he has these sort of discussions like what was going, what triggered the beginning. Sometimes there isn't something terribly identifiable, sometimes there is. When was the peak? Then what was the crash? Kind of what was going on, blah, 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 blah. Now you might have noticed something funny here. We have two different dates here. Peak and crash. Kindleberger basically describes three kinds of bubbles. Maybe I'll put up the graphs over here. Okay, so there's three basic patterns of bubbles. All right, time. I say there's a fundamental, let's assume the fundamental is constant plot. So one kind, which is what most people think of, it goes up, hits a peak, and then crashes. Pretty much all the theoretical models of bubbles, that's what they do. That stochastically crashing model of a rational bubble that I told you about, that's what it does. So what it does, of course, is that it has this thing accelerating more because you have this, you know, people having to be covered for this risk premium of the rising probability of the crash. But, you know, if you have a rational bubble, this is what you've got to have. The only people who are participating in the bubble are doing so because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Everybody's forecasting that, you know, everybody else is going to keep buying, and they do, and it goes up. And the minute it stops going up, there's absolutely no reason to buy. No rational agent's going to... Everybody's going to get the heck out, okay, and it's going to go back. And virtually all the theoretical models of bubbles, certainly ones with homogeneous rational agents, and there are some other ones, that's what they look like. Okay, another one, which some people think we would like to have, and these are, some people sort of would say you don't necessarily have a bubble, because a lot of people think the only way you really know you have a bubble is when you see that they really crash, is one that doesn't really crash. It goes up, and goes down, but they'll crash. And then finally, we have one that looks like this. It goes up, it's a peak, And then it drifts down for a while. Minsky called this the period of financial distress. And then it crashes. All right, anybody want to guess out of the 47 historical bubbles in Appendix B of the fourth edition of Kindleberger's book, how many of them look like the first pattern?
Very few.
No, four. Five.
Yeah, very few.
The silver bubble. Tulip mania gets figured on that, although if you actually go and read the history of the tulip mania, you don't really know what happened, because what happened was that the day it started to crash, they closed the market for 3 months! So they woke up the markets 3 months later. Well, yeah, the price is way down. No, but in fact, that's really not a classifiable one. Everybody thinks that it looks like that, okay? There's some other ones that are a little tricky. The high-tech crash sort of looks like that. It really went down awful fast, although the day of the steepest decline was about a month after it started to go down. That one's a little fuzzy, but I'd be willing, in our paper, we say that. So anyway, you got about five. Okay, how many think look like that? About another five. By the way, I think we've seen both of these in the last couple of years. I think oil was that. We had $147 a barrel, and 6 months later, we're $32 a barrel. Went down pretty darn hard. Once it peaked, it just went down. None of this funny stuff, and it wasn't all kind of gradual. All right, there's a real big one that looks like this.
And land prices looks like that.
The housing bubble. Actually, when I first was trying to get my thing up, I had the Case-Shiller Index. Look at the Case-Shiller Index. It goes up, it kind of peaks out around the middle of 2006. If you have better data from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which I don't have a chart for, peaks a little later, beginning of 2007. But there's never really been a crash in housing. Now, some of that has to do with the nature of real estate. You have certain specific markets. Where do you get a crash in real estate? It's when you've got commercial developers who are the flippers. Okay, so you get flippers who are running around getting all leveraged to, speculate on, I got a bunch of condos, and here I am, I'm all leveraged up, and then, oh my God, I got margin calls, and I got a, so you get a few, condo markets or something to crash, but with family residential homes, people don't have to sell. What you see is a collapse of volume.
Yeah.
People go, this is my house. I know how valuable my house is. Oh, nobody wants to give me what I want for my house. Oh, I just won't sell my house. I'll rent or something. I'll go hide in a corner. So you don't get this massive crash. You don't get this rushing for the exits phenomenon, which is the crash, the panic. You get this depressed attitude where, and Japan, actually I had long correspondence with Kindleberger, the Japanese real estate market is totally weird. It's actually the exception. The thing went up really fast and it has gone like that. It's still going down since 1991! except for downtown Tokyo. Richard?
Yeah, it's real important. You all have prices here. And imagine a labor market. Labor market's going to look, the price thing, it's going to go down very gradually. But what would go down in your world, but it goes up. Unemployment rising at half a percentage point a month is a crash. Rise. So what you just said about the volumes versus the prices. In the housing market, that's not so important.
Yeah.
But I can't just hold my job.
Right, and sit there. Right.
I've lost it. So there's actually, it just struck me, really interesting with the way once one gets out of the financial markets, we almost automatically shift to, from the prices aren't the thing that's jumping. It's the quantities.
Right. Especially in real estate. Okay, what does that mean? By at least we counted 37 out of the 47. Like this. That's the real history. And all the really big ones. Well, maybe not the housing bubble. Mississippi bubble peaked in December of 1619, crashed in April of, 1719, crashed in April of 1720. The South Sea bubble peaked in April of 1720, crashed in September of 1720. 1929 stock market. Peaked at the beginning of September 1929, crashed on October 19th. 1987 stock market peaked in August, about the time Greenspan came in. As Fed chairman, crashed October 19th. Okay, we can go on and on and on. Most of the really, really, really big famous bubbles, they look like that. Now, the length of that period of financial distress, that's highly flexible. You know where they are because in Kindleberger's appendix, these are different dates. Sometimes it's as low as 1 month, a lot of times it's 3 or 4 months, sometimes it's over a year. In this latest business, I think the one that did that was the derivatives market. Peak was August 2007. The crash was the Minsky moment of September 18th, 2008, when all hell broke loose. Okay, well, I'm not going to drag you through the details, I'm over time, but I will simply note that this paper with Galagotti and Palestrini, which is on my website, will probably be published in Macroeconomic Dynamics, hopefully before the end of the year, finally, uses a Brockhaus type agent-based model. It's got some wealth constraints, got a few other bells and whistles, but basically we are able to generate patterns that show periods of financial distress. You get a peak, you get a period of financial distress, and then you get a crash, which standard theory does not show you how to do. And you really have to have heterogeneous agents, and everybody knows this. Because what's going on? You know? This is the smart insiders get out. What's going on here? It's all the suckers. You know, and you go back and read the old literature from the South Sea Bubble, and you read the banker, Martin, all this stuff we're talking about. Oh, yeah, when the rest of the world is mad, the intelligent person has to be mad. What's going on? Now, John Law complained after the peak of the Mississippi Bubble that all the true Mississippians, and he really believed in his bubble, and he really believed that, you know, he was doing great things for the French economy. He's the founder of New Orleans. New Orleans was founded. This was an unemployment issue. John Law was so powerful that they were picking up vagabonds. The first European settlers of the city of New Orleans were vagabonds who were picked up off the streets of France, unemployed people, by the, you know, French police. Pick them up and stuck them on boats and ship them over to New Orleans. Okay, you're going to, you know, find the gold and develop everything. You know, all the true Mississippians like Caleb, all they left. And who do you have? In the South Sea Bubble, Martin says, oh, yeah. Who's the devil who takes the hindmost? Well, you have the widows and orphans and ministers and spinsters and all these pathetic suckers, you know? You know, the shoeshine boys. There's somebody who never, grandma who never invests. Everybody has been telling, oh, you get money, you're going to make money. And so finally, grandma takes her money out of her cookie jar or mattress and puts her life savings at the peak of the bubble, and there she is. You know, what a praise, let it go up. You know, the poor sucker. And finally, you know, they're all forced out and lose money. Okay, so. So that's really it. Okay, so you know, there's a lot more in the paper. I can say a lot more. Maybe we have time for questions, but I'm going to stop talking here right now. There might be another slide. Let me see. What's this? There's a conclusion. Okay, there's a conclusion. Well, you can read it. I had a whole thing about that. Was the last presentation I did. It was at the Krasno Institute, so I had a whole thing about complex dynamics in the brain and neuroscience and blah, 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 and neuroeconomics, but that's probably not a topic here to talk about.
Why don't we take a few questions?
You have more questions. I'll just stand here.
Okay, well,
identify. I think Eric got his hand up first.
Some questions, and then we can move on. Eric.
Let it go. Eric got his hand up first, I think.
So, riffing off of Richard here, if you were going to take some hedonic descriptors of speculative bubbles, how many of these things could be uniformized by, instead of looking at one variable and say this is the variable for this kind of crash and this is the variable for another, in a multivariate setting, to what extent could you come up with a taxonomy that reveals a smaller variety of such things? And I wanted to play off of what you're saying at the end, which is that these are vehicles by which wealth is transferred amongst players who have different presentations. And one of the key features which you're talking about with Granny is the utility of novelty when some agents haven't seen particular features of the market. For example, it's been N years in a financial market since there's been some sort of a speculative run-up, and then you have a bunch of new folks who've never seen it before, all of their daily experiences with some other thing, and you have a few old hands, you know, who've seen it a few times. I guess what my question is one, can I come up with four or five hedonic descriptors of a crash so that they become uniformized, and is there effectively a novelty tax that one can use to think about these things as deliberate, as almost deliberate agents of transfer?
Okay.
that a crash is an opportunity to transfer wealth from those who have experience to those who do not. Anyway, the reverse.
I don't think I have a quick answer to that. I think that there does seem to be some patterns about these different kinds of crashes, and some of it does seem to be what's being speculated on. You know, ones that look like this, real estate is more likely to be like that. These sometimes seem to be more like straight commodities, like silver or oil or tulip bulbs. Financial markets seem to be more likely to be this. You've got lots and lots of agents, lots and lots of people in there. And so, you know, but exactly how you... And there's also the fact that, sort of in some sense, every bubble has its own peculiar history.
I can suggest, too, in response to your question.
Go on.
You know, when we build these models, we build them up out of cycles, and they have cycle times. And I think one thing, this is just intuition, but I think one thing you'll find is that extremely short cycle things can come apart faster than long cycle things. To your point, you know, if a guy doesn't have to, you know, he doesn't have to have somewhere to live anyway, doesn't like the market, stays out in mortgage, housing, those are long cycles. When you have millisecond executions in trading markets, those are extremely short cycles. Those are short cycles. Those are so short that we don't even process in our own mammalian neurons that fast. And so, you know, stuff can happen fast. I mean, it's almost tautological, but yeah. I think it's a big thing. And I think the hierarchy of these cycle times in these models has been, this is something we've been talking about, you know, very diligently in the last year or two. We'd like to get better at understanding the taxonomy of cycle times. The second thing, and I think at least you can certainly see it in the dot-com, and you can certainly see it in the financial crisis. If you imagine a primitive tribe that you might talk about with your friends in biology, just to think about things, they work on being balanced up. You need to have some folks hunting. You need to have some gatherers. You need to take care of the children. You need maybe a shaman or something like this and a medicine man. But if everybody in the tribe wants to be medicine man, tribe gets screwed up. The other stuff doesn't work right. In that dot-com crash, everybody in the world suddenly thought they had a website, that they were going to be the next Bill Gates. There was just a flood of people running in there. Some of my pals in the VC community quit calling them entrepreneurs and called them opportuneurs. You know, everybody was going to be a big risk taker. Just a flood of people going into this, and it got out of balance. And we've had a very consistent flood of people going into these financial markets. And at some certain point, you just say, hey, if everybody is a bond trader, you know, who's going to serve dinner? Who's going to clean the toilets? Who's going to get the gas here? Who's going to feed us? And so when you get the imbalances in the distribution of activities, I think that's another one. That would be harder to cast into.
Yeah, I think the most important consideration is the extent to which any particular bubble or the set of bubbles in the financial markets that are coupled with investment in real assets. And one of the really interesting ways to think about all this is in terms of the endogenous bubbles associated with major technological innovations over the last 200 years. In fact, you take it back further and say even the South Sea bubble and the Mississippi bubble were associated with the major innovations of the exploration and peopling of the New World. But starting with the canals in England, and then the successive railroad booms, and then electrification, and then more common, actually, curiously enough, in the 20s, you do have an association
RCA.
With broadcasting, with the RCA, of course, of classic age, not big dollars, but, and then obviously the internet boom. There's both a need for an awful lot of money to build out networks before you have enough people on the network to generate enough traffic to deliver a return, and it's enormously speculative as to what that will be. And then second, and this is the dot-com example, of course, you need this kind of Cambrian explosion of, so what are we going to do with this stuff when it's built out? And I always like to think of you know, Amazon as in a way the canonical example. It took $5 billion to get to positive cash flow when Jeff realized he had to build out his own distinctive, peculiar logistics infrastructure, and that could only have been funded in a bubble. So one of the, in a way, peculiar dangers of say, well, now let's have a really boring financial system and no bubbles, and bubbles are terrible, and they transfer wealth from the strong to the weak, is you can have a really boring economy as well. And you know, there's a literature on this that is quite, I'm afraid, unfortunately, really decoupled from what 90% of what we're talking about
here.
Isn't
that one of the points of Carlota Perez?
Yeah, Carlota Perez is very much, but you know, Carlota, who might, in a sense, like, kind of discovered her and introduced her to IBM and all that, does not do rigorous modeling of this. It is narrative and it's descriptive and it's very provocative, and there's a whole research set of research programs that are generated once you start thinking about this. And as usual, if you go back to chapter 12 of the general theory, which I see that Brad DeLong has up on his website today, you will find a reference from Keynes.
The most brilliant chapter in the world.
You'll find a reference. You find Keynes speaking about when it's when you can take something public on the stock exchange. Why would you buy? You know, it for a pretty huge profit. That provides an enormous incentive to invest. And this is where the coupling between the financial and the quote real economy, I think, is absolutely fundamental.
Let me say one more thing. You can restate this exact point, and I think Don could do it better than me, but in sort of the old complexity science language of Santa Fe, which is there's this frozen ordered regime, deep in the ordered regime, nothing happens. There's an edge of chaos out here somewhere. You know, if you don't continually look around to see where the edge of chaos is and move to, you can't adapt, and you know, you don't have enough alternatives, and if you don't know where the phase transition occurs, you could drop off the edge, and that's very bad, and there's actually some pretty cool science about how to think about that, and that's just the same point made in different language.
Why don't we take one more question and then move to the next
So I want to pick up on this thread here. I think this is really important, and it goes exactly to why this homo selectus stuff is not just a glib, fun term. I think you're really onto something with respect to thinking about, let's say, a hunter-gatherer group and what motivates them to stay, to leave, sort of thing. And what I want to get at is that this tendency to go for broke that you were talking about in the dot-com bubble, where everybody wants to set up a website and be the next Bill Gates, and possibly be what they're all going to be, is actually reflective of something very ancient that actually goes way back into our vertebrate history and probably before, which is that we see creatures do things that at the level of the individual are utterly shocking. Like we see salmon, for example, which are typically, as you know, return to their natal stream, swim to some other stream. And for a long time, biologists regarded that as an error. Saw these as erratic mistakes, that they had gotten the wrong message. But if you rethink it, you realize that in order for every stream on the Pacific coast to have a salmon run, a certain number of individuals have to find that stream after the cohort has been wiped out by an avalanche or something like that. And so there's a certain number of open niches. The individual who returns to their stream is expected to replace himself in the population, you know, better on average. But the individual who finds an empty stream, they found an entire population, which evolutionarily speaking is a huge payoff, like being a Bill Gates. And so I guess the point I would make about this homo selectus model here is that the thing that motivates people to do something seemingly insane, like get on a boat and cross a horizon when they don't know what's on the other side and there may be nothing and they'll probably die, is the fact that things back home aren't so good. The number of opportunities are not great, and the hazard of getting caught in something bad is high. And so the point is, in those circumstances, it may make a kind of long-term rational sense to face near certain death with the possibility of founding a new population. And so what I would argue is, if this is right, and this is just a hypothesis here, but if this is right, the way to demotivate people from going for broke and causing the conditions that produce a collapse is to increase security low down in the hierarchy. Now, I don't know if I'm talking about the poor there or people low down in the investor hierarchy or what, but point is, if people get a reasonably good deal in the economy where they are, they will be much less likely to create the volatility that causes these problems. That would be my guess. So I'll leave it at that.
A couple of remarks by me after
sure.
all these. Okay, well, I'll keep it short since I know we need to move on. One is Bill's point, he's right, I think you do need some enthusiasm about getting real investment. You need a lot of this involves getting a certain level of scale, and so you have to kind of get the animal spirits going, and it may need these excess returns. I was reminded about this boring thing. I gave the underlying paper here. Lee and I were at a conference several years ago in Bielefeld, Germany, and I gave a seminar actually to the department separately on the paper here. And I was talking about housing bubbles. Oh, we got a housing bubble and this, blah, 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 blah. And so one of the people in the audience, Billy Zemler, says, well, you know, for those of you who don't know, Germany had falling housing prices through that whole period. He says, you know, we here in Germany, we really kind of like to have a housing bubble. You know? It's really fun to have housing. A deeper point is that there's a huge literature now. Most people have kind of dismissed this. It's kind of, you know, so unsafe. But there's long been people who've argued that you can never really prove that there is a speculative bubble. Okay, they call it the misspecified fundamental hypothesis. But let me give you the sort of argument. Okay, 1929. Okay, what you have to think about is think about an underlying distribution being some kind of skewed distribution. And so people going forward, they have rational expectations. They're sitting there worrying about these possible tail outcomes, okay? Especially if it's asymmetric. So you have, you know, in the 1920s, Irving Fisher going, I mean, I have this great quote from Irving Fisher. He's, oh, you know, unions are busted and we've got prohibition, so workers are working hard. They're not all alcoholic drunks. And we've got, you know, all these new technologies and new economy. And we got this, we've got that. And we've solved all the economic problems. And there was a certain probability that that was correct. Now, afterwards, you go, oh, they're just idiots. Look, there was a Great Depression. But as a matter of fact, the Great Depression was the ultimate tail event. Anybody forecasting we're going to have a Great Depression would have been nuts. Okay? They would have been right, but, you know, that was a totally out. So all of these events that you look afterwards is very easy. Oh, look, these people were fools. They're buying, the thing crashed. But the people are buying at any given point, there's some probability that, oh, it's going to keep going, or there really is some new economy. There really is. All those eyeballs are all going to turn into revenue-making companies or something like this. So, you know, the misspecified, the only way you get a misspecified fundamental fund is to do something like closed-end funds where you've got an underlying net asset dot and say, oh, we've got a premium on this closed-end fund of 100%. Whoops! Oh, their fundamental is the net asset dot plus or minus some, you know, taxes and management fees, more than 10%. So you got to see a 100% premium. That's a bubble. You better get the heck out. Okay. Final thing is, I can't really tell what's going to happen with these, but, you know, there's a lot of markers of bubbles. Don't read Gentleberger. A lot of this is psychological. When you start hearing people saying that the sky is the limit, okay, this is going to go on forever, that's one marker. Get the heck out. Another one is increasing leverage. This almost always happens. Yep. It's an endogenous process. I mean, I knew that the housing bubble was really getting near the end when I picked up, I follow the Metro, the real estate section, I teach German economics in the Washington Post, I pick up and I saw that a majority of the mortgages, this is early 2005, the majority of the mortgages were exotic mortgages that involved no paying down of principal. I said, oops, this is it, you know.
Same thing in the leverage.
It's just, you know, this has gone too far, you know, this is going to blow, any minute here it's going to blow. So, you know, there are a number of these kinds of markets where you have people going around, you know, And you, you know, you get these surveys and people are, why are people, why are people buying? They're buying to get a capital gain. They're not buying for the fundamental. They're buying because they think the price is going to go up and they're going to make a capital gain. When that's driving the market, you're in a bubble. So, you know.
There's also some behavior that's encouraged and rewarded too.
Oh, yeah. Well, all this stuff feeds back. It all feeds back because the money, people are making money and people get rewarded.
It's a tax advantage to having a mortgage versus renting. Yeah. That drives a lot of behavior.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to shut my thing off.
Thanks so much, Barclay. Right. That was a great discussion.